It's Monday, November 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, President-elect Trump begins the work of forming his cabinet.
Went for a real long time, just kept on shaking, and sort of messed up our houses a wee bit in the way of, you know, stuff falling off shelves and smashing and all that sort of thing.
We hear from a resident at the epicenter of a powerful earthquake in New Zealand. Also ahead, the Obama administration's plan for climate change and the cinematic story of Loving. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's campaign rhetoric has sowed anxiety and confusion about the foreign policy path that he will pursue. During the Republican primaries and in the general election contest against former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the wealthy businessman was vague on some key issues, including the fight against the so-called Islamic State group, trade, nuclear, and climate. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins me in the studio to discuss the first order of business, and that is forming his cabinet.
Jim, with any incoming administration, there are decisions that are made long before someone takes the oath of office that really shape the trajectory of the administration and really the performance of the administration, whether it hits the ground running. It can also provide certain clues as to what is immediately on the agenda. And here we have Donald Trump, who very famously promised to drain the swamp in Washington. And so the big question becomes, you have to fill out a government, and you need a certain number of people who have some experience in Washington. So how do you fill your cabinet? How do you round out your administration? When from the very beginning you have promised to essentially kick the Washington types out on their ear. And I think we're going to be looking very closely at this. Announcements could come at any moment, but there are some very familiar names already being bandied about.
Presumably, as an outsider, Donald Trump will need some help from the, quote, inside to guide his way through this, because we're not just talking about filling a handful of positions. This is a lot of work to do in a little over 2 months from now.
Indeed. Jim, look, just consider the posts that have to be filled. Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, Attorney General, and then all of the other agency and cabinet heads that have to come along, not to mention someone to serve as your press secretary. There are just a wide variety of posts here. And some of the names are quite familiar. I mean, not surprisingly, those who came out in favor of Donald Trump early on and were his, you know, sort of fiercest defenders, even in some of the darkest days of the campaign, people like former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, someone like Alabama Republican Senator Jeff Sessions. These are names that are being discussed. Others, Newt Gingrich, former House Speaker, but someone who hasn't been in government for about 20 years. That's another name that's being discussed. I don't know that any of these names really qualify as draining the swamp, but perhaps that was a bit of a rhetorical flourish, and perhaps his policies will aim to drain the swamp, even if they're being implemented by people that certainly have had their hands in the swamp at various times.
Donald Trump, I mean, we're from what we've seen on the outside, rewards those who stick with him and does not reward those who are against him. So it would stand to reason that the folks that have been with him during the campaign, staunchly supporting him, are going to have some sort of role in this. He also said many times on the campaign trail that he wanted to get away from the status quo in government and find the best and the brightest minds to run government. As far as outside names, I don't think we've really seen a whole lot in that category yet.
We haven't. And here's the other factor. The administration has to work with the Congress. Now, Donald Trump will be coming into office with a huge advantage in that both the House and the Senate are controlled by the Republican Party. He will have Republican majorities in both houses of Congress. But look at who leads those houses of Congress. Mitch McConnell. There is hardly a more establishment Republican in Washington than Mitch McConnell. Paul Ryan is something of an outsider type and something of a wonky person who's been at the forefront of various Republican budget and tax proposals. He is the House Speaker. But nevertheless, he is going to have to work with a if not a Republican establishment, certainly Republican majorities that are very much entrenched in Washington and in the ways of Washington. Congress is coming back to work in the next couple of days, and Donald Trump has already come to Washington. He's already met with Mitch McConnell. He's already met with Paul Ryan, and they've mapped out their strategy going forward. But definitely, if his agenda is to be enacted, it's going to be Republicans on the Hill and Republicans in the administration working hand in hand.
Certainly, it has been proven in U.S. politics that the fortunes of individuals can turn on a dime, and apparently the fortunes of parties can turn on a dime as well. And that's what makes us so fascinating as we move forward and watch it. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman. Mike, thanks for sharing all of your insights with us today.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
We now turn to our next segment to check out what people are saying on the web. International Edition social media guru G. Abby Lee joins me here in the studio. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
So what's next after the election?
That's what a lot of people are discussing on social media. So Sunday talk shows spearheaded the talks on how the two major parties and the country will move forward.
And what are the main topics of discussion?
I'll say mainly two things: anti-Trump protests and the leadership in the Democratic Party. On NBC News, Trump surrogate Rudy Giuliani said anti-Trump protesters are quote-unquote professionals and that they don't appear to be carefully studying political science. Now, to that, one Twitter user wrote, "Whether they carefully study political science or not, they still get to have a voice and an opinion. It's a democracy." On the other side of the spectrum, Hillary Clinton surrogate Cory Booker appeared on NBC News and talked about the protests, too. And about his interview, his critics urged him to look into his own party's hate and that there is a difference between protesters and rioters, implying that the protests were not peaceful in Portland, Oregon.
Well, there's also a massive rally scheduled for late January, correct? What are people saying about that?
Yeah, so the Million Women March is one of the trending topics on Twitter this Sunday, and that's a day after Trump's inauguration on January 21st. More than a million women are expected to protest his presidency. As many of our listeners already know, his treatment of women was an important issue during the campaign. And anyone interested in the march can check out the Women in the World account at Women in the World to receive updated news on the upcoming rally. And even men are chiming in on the conversation. One user tweeted, "All LGBT men should protest at inauguration in full drag to wingman the women and the girls of this country." Trump's female supporters, however, claim the march is un-American and showed their unwavering support for the president-elect. To those tweets, his critics said, "Protest is protected by the First Amendment's right for free speech and right to assembly." Jim, back to you.
All right. Thank you so much, G. As always, you can follow us on Twitter on our program account. That's at @VOA_IE. I'm out there as well as G, at VOA Stevenson, and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, South Korean prosecutors to question President Park about corruption scandal. Some refugees held in Australian camps to be resettled to the United States. Blast kills more than 50 at crowded Sufi shrine in Pakistan. Afghan parliament unseats foreign minister and two other cabinet members. Kashmir's Wular Lake worth more restored, but will India pay? You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website. Also, if you have a smartphone, follow along using the VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. New Zealand officials confirm two people have died after a powerful 7.8 earthquake hit 90 kilometers from Christchurch, the biggest city on New Zealand's South Island. The quake caused some damage to buildings more than 200 kilometers away in the capital, Wellington. John Dauber is the manager of the Four Square store in Hamner Springs at the epicenter of the quake, and John joins us by telephone from his store to tell us what he felt and saw.
At 12:03, we got hit real hard by an earthquake. Went for a real long time, just kept on shaking, and sort of messed up our houses a wee bit in the way of, you know, stuff falling off shelves and smashing and all that sort of thing. Structurally, everyone's, from what I've heard, is okay, you know, their properties and all that. And then my wife and I and settled the kids are okay, they've just got a couple of little wee ones. I took off down to the store, so I knew the first thing you need to do is I knew it'd be a mess down here, so you got to get the store open, especially for a small community. So that was my, once the family, I knew the family was okay, the focus was getting the store open. So had some volunteers come off the street and two staff turned up, and we worked from 12:30 through to about 5 o'clock this morning and got the floor all cleaned up as best we can. It's pretty sticky, but it's safe. It's cleaned up and managed to get the doors open at 8 o'clock for the community. Well, they were lining up about 7:30, actually.
Are you able to keep the store fairly stocked, or are things coming off the shelves fast?
Things are coming off the shelves fast, particularly water. We've got there's no water at the moment. They're not recommending to drink the water, so... Fortunately, I've got a storage shed off-site storing water for the summer. Brought a whole lot of water in for the summer coming up. So we're just going on to we just sold two pallets and we're on to our third pallet. And the pallet of water normally lasts me about a week.
What were the streets like as you were making your way to the store?
It was just sheer darkness. But like you wouldn't know there was had been an earthquake. All the roading infrastructure is all fine around here. It was just a long quake, real long, kept going and going and going, and it just didn't let up. It was powerful, but not like real big hard jolts that could really give structures a bit of a hurry up.
This was much more powerful than the one that you endured 5 years ago.
Yeah, well, see, and thankfully we've got a bit of experience. I'm from Canterbury, I'm from Christchurch, my wife and I, so we've sort of been through all that. So we've been in the retail game and was involved with the cleanup and supermarkets back then. So we sort of knew what we needed to do and where to keep our focus on. And it's all about just keeping the doors open. It was fierce, and it's just lucky it was just in a more in a rural area where there's no tall buildings or anything like that.
And the power is still on?
Power's off. I've got a generator, so I'm came down. So the generator's up and going, so we can maintain our freezers and chillers, and more importantly, our checkout, so we can operate and serve the community.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the stories you've heard from the folks coming into the store?
There's been a couple of fatalities from what I've heard around the district, not in the Hamner Springs area, but Wyau, another wee township, and I think Mount Lightford, I think. They're just areas only 30 or 40 kilometres away from us. Someone's had a heart attack and someone's been crushed or something. That's the sort of stories we've heard. So we're sort of hoping they aren't true, but from what we've heard, they probably are. There's a lot of infrastructure on the east coast, Kaikoura coastline. We're hearing that there are big slips down there, and that's the State Highway 1 off the South Island. So if there's slips and there's some tunnels, we've heard that could be badly damaged. If that's the case, that can become quite serious for transport up and down the coastline.
Well, John, it's good to hear you're okay. And, John, thank you so much, and good luck.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Bye.
John Dauber, manager of the Four Square store in Hamner Springs at the epicenter of the New Zealand quake. Reports say thousands of residents in the coastal area of New Zealand had to flee their homes for higher ground after tsunami warning sirens were activated in South Island coastal towns. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, visiting New Zealand, admits it's a race against time to implement the Paris Agreement on climate change. He says the Obama administration will do all it can to do so before climate change skeptic Donald Trump, the U.S. president-elect, takes office.
Until January 20th, when this administration is over, we intend to do everything possible to meet our responsibility to future generations to be able to address this threat to life itself on the planet.
The United States accounts for just under a fifth of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. Trump says global warming is a hoax perpetrated by China to gain an economic advantage. In the Moroccan city of Marrakesh, almost 200 nations are taking part in a two-week UN conference to turn promises into action on climate change. Chinese delegates say regardless of the U.S. election outcome, China could assume the climate change leadership mantle. Liu Chang is director of China's National Center for Climate Change.
I think that's from this perspective, China will take the leader, especially actively participating all kinds of activities in addressing climate change.
Well, for years, Beijing fought attempts by foreign governments to limit carbon emissions. You can visit voanews.com for much more on this story. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Based on a true story, the new movie titled Loving offers an intimate portrayal of Richard and Mildred Loving, a white man and a black woman who defied the laws of their native Virginia in 1957 and got married in neighboring Washington, D.C. The events that unfolded changed America. VOA's Penelope Palou spoke with the filmmaker and lead actors in this dramatized landmark story.
I'm gonna build you a house right here. Our house. Would you marry me?
Richard and Mildred get married in the nation's capital.
I now pronounce you husband and wife.
But their union is illegal under the Racial Integrity Act of Virginia, where they live.
In here?
Richard!
What you doing in bed with that woman?
I'm his wife.
They are arrested, accused, and found guilty.
Richard Perry Loving, being a white person, and Mildred Jeter, being a colored person, did unlawfully cohabitate as man and wife.
Richard?
The couple has to leave Virginia or face prison. In 1958, they moved to Washington, D.C., away from friends and family. 5 years later, in 1963, inspired by the civil rights movement, Mildred writes to U.S. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, asking for help. She is then contacted by the Washington chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union.
I believe this is a court battle that could go all the way to the Supreme Court.
Filmmaker Jeff Nichols relied on historical footage and an in-depth documentary about the couple.
I can take care of you.
I know that.
But the film's power lies in the way Nichols portrays a nuanced, deep love between two people whose only desire is to live a life together. In 1967, the Supreme Court ruled in their favor. Loving versus Virginia became a landmark case that overturned miscegenation laws around the country. At the recently inaugurated African American Museum in Washington, D.C., Jeff Nichols spoke to VOA about the Oscar buzz his film has generated.
So it's flattering and humbling, but what's important here is the story we're trying to tell, Richard and Mildred's story. I didn't know about it in 2012 when I first heard about it, and that's shameful. This is a fundamental part of our American history.
You think you'll lose?
We may lose a small battle, but win the big war.
Actress Ruth Negga pours her heart into the character of Mildred. Her soulful performance has earned her acclaim. She told VOA what really inspired her to play the reluctant activist was her admiration for her character's immense courage.
How do we find out who we are, really? And usually it's when we're in peril or when we are forced to find out who we are. You know, and I think that's when our true colors show, and it's when we discover our grit and our integrity.
Asked if a film such as Loving could speak to wide audiences in America's current climate of political polarization, Joel Edgerton, who plays Richard Loving, told VOA.
We keep running into the same problems. They'll always be there. And so it's always good to have new stories and sometimes gentle stories that allow us to take a walk, an empathetic walk in someone else's shoes. And I think it's a very special film that will resonate.
Is there anything you'd like me to say to them? And by them, I mean the Supreme Court justices of the United States?
Tell the judge I love my wife.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our home. That's voanews.com, one of the many ways you can listen to the program. Also, check us out on Facebook at VOA Now and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Aydin Utku. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. Thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. Come back again.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The latest report by an independent investigative panel of experts confirms that the Assad regime is responsible for a third chemical weapons attack on the Syrian people. In its October 2016 report, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, United Nations Joint Investigative Mechanism, or JIM, concluded the Syrian Arab Armed Forces used weaponized chlorine in the town of Khmenes in 2015. This latest finding followed an August 2016 report, where the JIM concluded that Syrian Arab Armed Forces used helicopters to drop barrel bombs filled with chlorine gas on the civilian population of Sarmin in 2015 and had attacked the town of Talmenes in a similar way in 2014. That report additionally found that Daesh used mustard gas in an attack in 2015 in Mareya. The leadership panel of the JIM reaffirmed its belief that it is absolutely critical to hold those who use or intend to use chemicals as weapons accountable for their acts. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner noted that the JIM's investigation corroborated what we have known for years. The Assad regime has systematically and repeatedly used chemical weapons against its own people. In a statement, U.S. National Security Council spokesperson Ned Price condemned in the strongest possible terms the Assad regime's defiance of the long-standing global norm against chemical weapons use. The United States, he said, continues to work with our international partners to enforce accountability through appropriate diplomatic mechanisms, including through the United Nations Security Council and the OPCW. On October 31st, the UN Security Council unanimously extended, through Resolution 2314, the mandate of the Joint Investigative Mechanism until November 18, 2016, in order to allow additional time for the Security Council to reach agreement on a year-long renewal of the JIM. This renewal would allow the JIM to continue to probe into the documented use of chemical weapons in Syria. U.S. Deputy Permanent Representative to the UN, Ambassador Michelle Sisson, welcomed the Security Council's adoption of Resolution 2314, noting that the Security Council must condemn and hold responsible whoever is involved in these chemical weapons attacks, and the JIM is a key tool to help us do that. National Security Council spokesperson Price said, "We must send a strong signal that the use of weapons of mass destruction will not be tolerated by the international community."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.